The headlines this hour. Iran's president says that his country's fundamental policies will not change, no matter who becomes the next U.S. president.
It is up to the U.S. government to align itself with these policies or distance itself from them.
Thousands of Armenians rally in the capital Yerevan, demanding the resignation of the country's premier over the recent ceasefire deal with Azerbaijan. And Russia says the Sputnik V coronavirus vaccine shows 92% efficacy, 2 days after a German firm and its U.S. partner announced their successful trial of the vaccine. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian president says that his country's fundamental policies will not change, no matter who becomes the next U.S. president.
Our policies will not change. The Islamic Republic of Iran will pursue the same policy it has had so far. It is up to the U.S. government to align itself with these policies or distance itself from them. The administration of the outgoing U.S. president chose to distance itself from our policies. We wanted to fight terrorism, but they wanted to support it. We wanted regional nations to be free and independent, but the U.S. wanted to interfere in their affairs. We wanted peace and stability in the region, but they sought to continue war and sell weapons in the region.
President Rouhani said Iran's policy is based on respect for other nations and non-interference in their affairs. He said the country wants constructive interaction with the world and seeks to fight terrorism and end unilateralism. Rouhani said one of the reasons that incumbent Donald Trump failed to win the U.S. presidential election was that his administration was humiliated at the U.S. Security Council. That, Rouhani added, happened after Washington's anti-Tehran proposal was rejected outright by the Security Council's members. Iran's president said another reason that Trump lost was his mismanagement in the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. Journalist and commentator Seyed Mohsen Abbas says that the U.S. President Donald Trump has made many mistakes leading to his policy failures.
It's very hard to say which factor actually brought down Donald Trump. He made so many mistakes this year in terms of COVID-19. The way he handled that was abysmal. But he didn't have any foreign policy success. Although he didn't go to war in any new countries, he certainly tried regime change, psychological operations, the assassination of a diplomatic mission, which Commander Soleimani was obviously the main victim. So he carried out hugely dangerous acts which could have caused wars, world wars potentially as well. And his, irrational behavior certainly wasn't one even his partners in Europe could actually predict or were comfortable with. In fact, that's why most of the leaders, who his erstwhile colleagues, if you like, or allies, have been quick to congratulate Biden, even though the election is still being disputed in many ways. However, coming back to the Iranian region, will maximum pressure be lifted? This is the biggest issue. Can Biden commit to preventing the economic terrorism, which America has initiated long before Trump was in office, on Iran? Will the economic sanctions be reversed? Will Israeli expansionism be prevented? Is Iran going to be allowed to have ballistic missile programs? Because, you know, the American administration has been after that, and that's been in addition to the JCPOA negation or unilateral withdrawal by America.
The row over the recently held presidential election in the U.S. continues amid harsh rhetoric over the vote outcome that gives Democratic candidate Joe Biden a clean sweep. Speaking to Fox News on Tuesday, the White House press secretary claimed to be holding more than 200 pages of affidavits proving voter fraud. Kayleigh McEnany said these frauds include dead people voting as well as some casting their ballots multiple times. Meanwhile, the New York Times reported that no evidence of voter fraud or other irregularities have been found in any state. U.S. media have projected Biden a clear winner in the race, but incumbent President Donald Trump has refused to concede. He says that he is the legal winner and claims that he is being cheated out of victory. He has launched a slew of lawsuits to overturn the results. Thousands of Armenians have once again taken to the streets, demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan over his signing of a ceasefire agreement with Azerbaijan. Protesters defied a martial law ban on street rallies in the capital, Yerevan. They chanted slogans such as, "Nikol is a traitor." The new rally comes one day after protesters stormed and ransacked some government buildings. Tensions prevail across Armenia after Moscow brokered truce ended about 6 weeks of fighting between Baku and Yerevan over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Under the deal, Azerbaijan will keep all of its territorial gains, while Armenian forces will hand over control of several territories that they captured recently. Some 2,000 Russian peacekeepers are also deployed to the region to uphold the truce. The agreement sparked anger in Armenia, but celebrations in Azerbaijan.
After the deal was announced, people flooded the streets of Azerbaijan's capital to celebrate the end of the conflict and the gains made. Via the deal, Baku will hold on to areas of Nagorno-Karabakh that it took during the conflict, including the enclave's second city of Shusha, and between now and December 1st, ethnic Armenian forces must give up control of a slew of other territories.
I bow down in front of the families and mothers of the martyrs. We rejoice today at the cost of their children's blood. I bow down to them, that's all I can say.
However, over in Armenia there is no jubilation. Protesters have stormed the parliament, branding the prime minister a traitor and calling for him to resign. Although the leadership of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave says 1,200 of its defense forces have been killed and the main city of Stepanakert would have been lost within days if the fighting had continued, some say victory was possible. Armenia's prime minister says the deal was unbelievably painful but unavoidable.
Under the circumstances, making a different decision wasn't possible. I plan to give more details why it wasn't and tell everyone the reason behind last month's events. I can't do it right now for one simple reason, because we are in the process of stopping military action right now, and if I say something, I might endanger people.
Keeping a close eye on the conflict throughout, Iran, which shares borders with the disputed region, called for a peaceful settlement of the conflict that respected international law and the territorial integrity of Azerbaijan. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the arrangement will pave the way for a lasting political settlement. For now, the battle is over, and thousands of people will now be left to pick up the pieces of their shattered lives. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Russia says interim trial results show that a Sputnik V vaccine has been 92% effective in preventing the spread of COVID-19. The Russian Direct Investment Fund said the results are based on data from the first 16,000 trial participants who received both shots of the two-dose vaccine. Data that there were no serious side effects during the trials of the vaccine. The announcement came as Moscow is trying to keep pace with Western drug makers in the race for COVID-19 treatment. On Monday, Germany's BioNTech and U.S.'s Pfizer also announced their successful trial of a vaccine which they claimed was more than 90% effective. New developments come as the coronavirus continues to wreak havoc with over 50 million cases and 1.2 million deaths globally. The coronavirus continues to spread in Iran, with the country reporting its highest daily fatalities and infections since the pandemic began there in mid-February. The Iranian Health Ministry recorded 462 deaths in 24 hours, pushing the overall fatalities to more than 39,000. Over 11,700 people also tested positive for the disease during the same period. That was also an all-time high. Iran has registered over 715,000 cases so far. 27 of the country's 31 provinces are either in the red zone or in an alarming state based on the coronavirus scaling system. The government has already announced new restrictions across the country to curb the spread of the virus. The foreign ministers of Iran and Pakistan have expressed deep concern about the rising Islamophobia in the West. During a meeting in Islamabad, Mohammad Javad Zarif and Shah Mahmud Qureshi said insulting Muslim sanctities under the pretext of freedom of expression is unacceptable. The reaction came amid backlash against French President Emmanuel Macron's support for sacrilegious cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, as well as his recent Islamophobic comments. Elsewhere in the remarks, the top Iranian and Pakistani diplomats also called for boosting ties between their countries to achieve regional peace. Tehran has hosted an interreligious gathering with the French government's anti-Islamic rhetoric as its theme. Attended by scholars from different divine religions, the event seeks to promote peace and tolerance among different faiths. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Clerics from major monotheistic religions gathered here in Tehran for an important goal: to promote peace based on religious commonalities. Delegates representing Islam, Christianity, and Judaism unanimously agreed that the root cause of intolerance and extremism lies in the lack of dialogue among religious leaders.
The divine books of Christianity and Judaism both speak highly of the last prophet named Muhammad. The Holy Quran has a special chapter about Saint Mary and Moses, so religions don't have any issues with each other. Therefore, it is upon us scholars to raise awareness and enlighten the minds of our people to respect other religions.
This session comes against the backdrop of repeated acts of blasphemy in France against the sanctities of Muslims. Scholars slammed the French government for lending its support to the growing anti-Islamic rhetoric in the country. This as President Emmanuel Macron argues that he seeks to promote freedom of speech. These people say freedom of expression is praiseworthy as long as it does not contradict the right to freedom of religion.
What the French president says is merely based on his deeply entrenched racist mentality. His comments on Islam have nothing to do with free speech. His actions are aimed at spreading Islamophobia to further marginalize Muslims. Now you tell me, is this freedom of speech or is it suppression of Muslims' right to a free religion?
Iran is home to different religious minorities, from Christians and Jews to Zoroastrians. All are represented in the parliament. Scholars believe peaceful coexistence among religions hinges on a collective effort by religious leaders to sit and talk based on their commonalities.
Representatives of different religions here say what the French president describes as freedom of speech is in fact freedom of hate speech, not only against the sanctities of Muslims, but against all monotheistic religions, since they believe in the same God and honor each other's prophets. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Syrian president says U.S. economic sanctions against his country are hampering efforts to return thousands of refugees to their homeland.
The return of refugees is very difficult due to economic and illegal sanctions enforced by the U.S. and its allies. The sanctions are creating a burden for the Syrian government in its construction efforts to allow for better circumstances for the refugees to return.
Assad said foreign-backed terrorists fighting in Syria have displaced many people there. The Syrian president was addressing the International Conference on the Return of Syrian Refugees in the capital, Damascus. The conference has been organized by Russia and Syria. It aims to discuss avenues to facilitate the safe return of the Syrian refugees to the country. A senior advisor to the Iranian foreign minister also addressed the gathering. Ali Asghar Haji called on the international community to provide the necessary infrastructure to facilitate the return of the refugees. Muhammad Ali earlier joined us from Damascus to give us details about the international conference underway there on Syrian refugees.
This is a very important conference, when we speak about it from the viewpoints of the Syrian government and Russia, and also the refugees in general, the Syrian refugees who wish to come back. Of course, this is the first international conference about the return of Syrian refugees to be held in the Syrian capital, Damascus. There are 27 countries participating over here, like Russia, Iran, even countries like Oman, and also countries like China, the UAE, for example. A lot of countries are here, and this is why it's a very important conference. Of course, it's about the return of Syrian refugees. The main goal of this conference is to send a message to the entire world to lift the sanctions, the economic sanctions imposed on Syria, because of those sanctions, the Syrian government is not being able to repair the infrastructure and create the suitable circumstances for the safe and normal return of the Syrian refugees. Most of the European countries that are known to be supportive to the opposition and to the armed groups did not attend. The European Union did not attend, of course, and all of the EU countries. We have to point out that the Syrian government sent invitations, official invitations, to all countries of the entire world, however, except for Turkey. The Syrian government sent invitations to all countries except for Turkey. The EU did not come. 27 countries came. Those who didn't come are either not concerned about the refugees issue, for example, they don't have refugees, Syrian refugees in their country, or they are against the return of Syrian refugees for their own goals.
Bahrain's longest-serving Prime Minister, Prince Khalifa bin Salman Al Khalifa, has died at the age of 84. According to Bahrain's official news agency, Khalifa died at Mayo Clinic Hospital in the U.S. The reason for his death has not been announced yet. Reports say a specific number of royal families will attend the burial ceremony once the body is repatriated. The kingdom has declared a week of national mourning. Khalifa took office one day after Bahrain declared independence from Britain in 1971. He was widely criticized for defending dynastic rule and his authoritarian response to the 2011 mass uprising against the Al-Khalifa regime. China has warned the U.S. against boosting relations with Taiwan. Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin says that China firmly opposes any attempts by the U.S. to establish official ties with Taiwan. Washington and Taipei have announced that they will hold economic talks this month. The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said the negotiations will signify a growing economic relationship with Taiwan. China considers Taiwan its own territory, with no right to have formal relations with other countries. Beijing has vowed to bring the island under its control. Philippines is bracing for yet another typhoon that has forced mass evacuations in eastern coastal communities. Authorities have ordered about 50,000 people to evacuate as Typhoon Vamco barrels towards the Philippines. It is expected to graze Catanduanes Island before making landfall on Luzon on Wednesday or early Thursday. Destructive winds and torrential rain are forecasted. Vamco is the 21st tropical storm to hit the Philippines this year, less than 2 weeks ago. The country was battered by Typhoon Gani. It was the strongest cyclone so far this year and killed 25 people in the Philippines. The UN has launched an appeal for over $45 million in funding to provide aid to those affected by Gani. European Union and British sources say that Brussels and London are likely to miss their mid-November deadline to clinch a post-Brexit trade deal. The sources say talks between the two sides in London to break a deadlock will go past the deadline. A summit of EU leaders on November 19th is now viewed by the bloc as the final deadline for a draft Brexit agreement. Britain left the EU in January, but its departure from the bloc's regulatory regime completes in December. The UK and the EU have held several rounds of talks to thresh out the terms of a new trade agreement. The thorniest problems to resolve remain the level of access to UK waters provided to EU fishing fleets and how to maintain the competition rules for business. When one thinks about Canada, perhaps cold weather and immigrant-friendly may come to mind, but there is another side to U.S.'s neighbor that is not that well known to the world, and that is its human rights record. And it is not the one that contains positive remarks. The question is, why has it gotten to this point, and what is the government doing about it?
Canada has always boasted itself about its human rights records on the international stage. Yet a recent report by Human Rights Watch says there's much to be done regarding human rights in Canada. According to the report, there remain considerable challenges to undoing decades of structural and systematic discrimination against Indigenous people in Canada. Inadequate access to clean, safe drinking water, federal government's reckless discrimination against Indigenous people by denying them funding for child and family services, and widespread discrimination against First Nations women and their descendants are just a few examples cited by the report. Back in September, the world was shocked after an Indigenous was left dying in a hospital after being mocked and insulted by the medical staff. The gruesome death was a reminder of systematic racism in the Canadian society. Back in June, the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, launched by the government in 2016 to address endemic levels of violence against Indigenous women and girls, released its final report. The inquiry made 231 recommendations and concluded that acts of violence against Indigenous women and girls amount to genocide. The Human Rights Report also blasted Canada's government for detaining children in immigration centres. According to reports, 118 children were detained or housed in a detention centre in 2018 to 2019.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Medical researchers are raising significant doubts on whether an agent of the human immune system causes some coronavirus patients to end up in the hospital with injured lungs and other organs struggling to breathe. What remains is a continuing mystery about what causes certain people to die from COVID-19 and how best to prevent that. What you just heard were words selected from an article written by journalist Gina Colata, who writes about science and medicine under the heading, An Explanation for Some COVID-19 Deaths May Not Be Holding Up. Stay with us for more of Gina Colata's article. Medical researchers are raising significant doubts about whether an agent of the human immune system causes some coronavirus patients to end up in hospital with injured lungs and other organs, struggling to breathe. What remains is a continuing mystery about what causes certain people to die from COVID-19 and how best to prevent that. A hypothesis that emerged early in the pandemic involves cytokine storm, an immune system response that is often invoked to explain several viral infections, and to many doctors it seemed to make perfect sense. Patients who died from COVID-19 were found to sometimes have little or no virus in their bodies. Their immune systems got rid of it, but in doing so, the hypothesis went, their body's defenses went rogue, spewing out powerful compounds, cytokines and other drivers of inflammation that fatally damage tissues and organs in a storm. But in a number of recent studies, some researchers say an agent suspected of causing the storm might not be the culprit, or that such storms might not happen in the way doctors believed. Not everyone agrees, though. Dr. Randy Cron, a professor of pediatrics and medicine at the University of Alabama at Birmingham in the United States, who has long studied cytokine storms, says some hospitalized COVID-19 patients do experience these immune overreactions, but he agrees that they are not identical to the reactions seen in other disorders, and much remains to be learned. The hypothesis is centered on one particular cytokine, interleukin 6, or IL-6. The belief that it might be the culprit in certain COVID-19 deaths began with reports from China early in the course of the pandemic. Doctors there said a patient who fared poorly had high levels of interleukin 6, or IL-6. The doctors tried using drugs that block IL-6, and the patient recovered. Similar reports followed there and also in Italy. A number of drugs that block IL-6 are on the market to treat rheumatoid arthritis. They also can stop severe immune reactions in other situations, such as a cytokine release syndrome that can occur with some cancer treatments and with adult onset of Still's disease, a rare form of inflammatory arthritis. But, said Dr. John Stone, a professor of medicine at Harvard University, these are not infections. Nonetheless, anti-IL-6 drugs quickly become a standard of care at many hospitals treating COVID-19 patients. The idea that they were quelling cytokine storms became widely accepted. It is so easy to have your brain remember the case that worked really well and ignore those that didn't work well, said Dr. Bruce Walker, an immunologist who is director of the Ragon Institute of Massachusetts General Hospital, MIT, and Harvard University, and was not involved in the new studies. Now, rigorous studies are failing to find that anti-IL-6 drugs are effective. Other studies are finding that IL-6 levels are not even highly elevated in COVID-19 patients compared to levels in other critically ill patients. 3 studies found no evidence that a commonly used interleukin-6 inhibitor or IL-6 inhibitor, a rheumatoid arthritis treatment, reduced the death rate in severely ill coronavirus patients. One issue is with the very term cytokine storm. It has no definition, said Dr. Carolyn Colfi, an intensive care medicine specialist at the University of California in San Francisco. It is a colorful and captured the imagination of doctors and much of the public, but with no definition there, there are no diagnostic criteria to show that such a thing is taking place. And even if there is, IL-6 might be a bystander rather than a driver. Hundreds of cytokines are released when the immune system goes into action. They drive and suppress one another in complex feedback loops. You take this thing like spaghetti that is connected in so many different ways, Dr. Walker said. It is optimistic, he added, to think that IL-6 will be the answer to everything. Until recently, there were no systematic studies asking if interleukin-6 or IL-6 levels really were unusually high in COVID-19 patients. It turns out that they're often not. Dr. Jonathan Parr, an infectious disease expert at the University of North Carolina, checked IL-6 levels in his medical center's COVID-19 patients early in the pandemic. They were difficult to interpret, but generally were well below those seen in other inflammatory syndromes, where there are 27 times higher. Dr. Carolyn Colfi reviewed measurements reported in 5 studies with a total of more than 900 seriously ill coronavirus patients. Their IL-6 levels range from normal to slightly higher than normal. And even when cytokine levels are sky high, drugs that squelch immune reactions do not help. Dr. William Fisher, a pulmonary and critical care physician at the University of North Carolina, said the idea of a cytokine storm comes up in every severe viral infection. Examples include AIDS, Ebola, flu, Lassa fever, SARS, and MERS, he said. But, he said, it can be difficult to tease apart what drives pathology, whether it's just the virus or both the virus and the very immune response that is needed to clear the virus. The next step should be a randomized clinical trial, in which patients are randomly assigned to receive the experimental treatment or not. Instead, Dr. Fisher says, trials, if they started at all, tended to begin after tens of thousands of patients had already gotten the drugs, which muddied the ability to prove safety and effectiveness. So if not for this cytokine storm, what could be injuring the patients? Inflammation from a variety of immune system overreactions may play a role, according to researchers. One piece of evidence is that the steroid dexamethasone, which broadly suppresses the immune system, can reduce the death rate. But IL-6 is not the only possible driver of a damaging immune response, Dr. Stone said. Other inflammatory chemicals such as ferritin appear, and so does CRP, a protein that is a sign of inflammation. Many COVID-19 patients also suffer from blood clots, which themselves might be damaging lungs and other organs. Dr. Walker cites another possibility. He was an author of a study that found that the virus can destroy germinal centers, places in lymph nodes where antibodies are produced. The result can be fewer antibodies and less effective ones. And it still remains possible that administering anti-IL-6 drugs may help if done earlier or later during a patient's illness. We need randomized clinical trials to answer these hard questions, Dr. Stone said. Dr. Carolyn Calfee said The new findings should be teaching doctors a lesson. We have to be really humble about biologic complexity, she said. For now, Dr. Walker said, he and many others are sadder but wiser about using anti-IL-6 drugs to treat COVID-19 patients. All of us were hopeful that this would work, he said, but it was definitely worth a try.
Inside Israel.
One of Israel's neediest group of people are the Holocaust survivors. They fear the impact of yet another coronavirus lockdown. Thousands of elderly and Holocaust survivors already live in poverty in Israel and are in need of daily help with food. As Israel enters the biggest recession ever and the social and political chaos ensues, not to mention the COVID-19 crisis and lockdowns in Israel, Holocaust survivors fear that they will be further neglected.
Every person has an existential anxiety. That's human nature. It grows in a time of crisis like the Holocaust or an international pandemic. It's an unseen enemy. Plus, there's a wave of information from the media, and you don't know if the information you receive is true. So it's very intense, and the situation takes you back to the past.
Now, the regime is forcing them to use sophisticated technologies to get their care and essential items that they need. The problem is that they're all very old and fragile and cannot easily adapt to such orders. Lonely and disconnected from life, they are ever so neglected in Israel. According to Israeli figures, there are around 200,000 Holocaust survivors living in Israel today. Although the regime often highlights their suffering, 33% of them are living below the poverty line. The rest of them face hardships. Over 66,000 Holocaust survivors do not have enough of an income to live a good standard life. Israeli media say that many Holocaust survivors have only been able to afford the very basics. A survey by the Foundation for the Benefit of Holocaust Victims in Israel found that 1 in 5 Holocaust survivors had to choose between food and other necessities over the past 2 years. Some Holocaust survivors can't afford to heat their homes in the winter and can't afford to buy food or medicine. Many of them have expressed anxiety over their deteriorating health or informed the authorities that they are afraid of running out of money, food, and medicine. The average age of an Israeli Holocaust survivor today is 87. It's been estimated that by 2025, all of the remaining survivors will have died. Their advanced age automatically positions them at the top of the list of populations at risk of contracting the coronavirus and suffering from its lethal complications. Over 15,000 Holocaust survivors died in Israel over the past year, data gathered by the Finance Ministry indicates. The German government has once again allocated more funds this time, $662 million. In the past, when funds would arrive to Israel, there was a problem of accountability. How those funds are distributed is a big question.
There have been instances where tens of Israeli elderly died one after another in nursing homes from COVID. And this shows to what degree the Israeli regime, even after COVID was well underway, did not take the necessary precautions to protect the lives of the elderly as it is its obligation to do so. And later, when many elderly Israelis were placed in hospitals, they could not be sent back to the nursing homes because the nursing homes were not safe for them. And many of them suffer from deep loneliness, depression, and sadness because they are not being visited and they are being disconnected from others. Holocaust survivors are facing an extremely delicate situation due to COVID-19. It's not only the fact that they are very worried about their survival rates and about surviving, it is also the fact that due to the lockdown, many of them are reliving the traumas that they experienced during the Holocaust from World War II that is are re-emerging in their imaginations and in their thoughts. So one would have hoped that the Israeli government would have provided them with psychologists and counselors to allow them to make it through this difficult moment as they relive horror moments of trauma that took place in the past. However, this unfortunately is not happening, and the Holocaust survivors are largely ignored. About 25%, a quarter, of elderly Israelis lives under the poverty line. And what that means is that many of them do not have sufficient warm meals, sufficient food to eat every day. They struggle to pay the monthly rent and they struggle to pay for their monthly medications. And their lives are in deep agony and in shame for their situation. Where there has been a ray of light, it did not come from the Israeli government, which provides insufficient funds to the elderly, which does not pay their bills as it should. It comes from ordinary Israelis who've been taking on the mantle to help the elderly and is reaching out to them.
On social media, users had this to say. Gail says, Germany has paid reparations to Holocaust survivors in the past. This is money to help them get through the pandemic. Schneider says that, in Israel, remember folks, anyone who was alive prior to 1945 and isn't dead is a Holocaust survivor. Call Grandpa and remind him to apply for that bag. Fanny Lou asks, aren't Jewish Holocaust survivors and their heirs getting reparations from the U.S. government? Didn't they get reparations from Germany? Zakoli says, haha, okay, so it's okay for Holocaust survivors to get reparations, but not African Americans from Europeans?
Of course, they would suffer more than others because the average age of Holocaust survivors is 87 now, and anyone over 60 is considered at a high risk of, I think the mortality rate is 1 in 10 if you're over 60. So if you're over 80, it's probably 1 in 2. So of course, they're going to be very worried, and also because they are generally alone, they're old, their spouse, if they have one, has died, and then all they have are their memories. And the older you get, the more your memories take over and control your thinking and your living. So of course they are the ones that are suffering. And also, if they're living in Orthodox neighborhood, where if they're practicing Jews, that's not necessarily the case with Holocaust survivors, but if they are, then that infection rate is very high, because the Orthodox Jews, like fundamentalist Christians and even Muslims, want to worship. They really want to be together to worship, and this COVID crisis is making it impossible for people to commune and have that religious experience. So, yes, it's a very sad situation now for. Them. The funds, it's a very complex history of the Holocaust funds. Germany, of course, is providing most of these. Certainly at a state level, it is the one responsible. Although there are also claims on Poland, and this is getting very very tense now, because Israel is insisting on even looking at Czechoslovakia, other East European countries where Jews were, and France as well. I believe France is also contributing because of the Vichy government that was collaborating with Hitler. So it's a complex situation, but the Germany has been providing funds, but since 1952, the funds are all going to something called the Jewish Claims Conference in New York. And this is a big bureaucracy now to distribute funds to Holocaust survivors, not just in Israel, but around the world. But of course, like all big organizations, it's very bureaucratic, and it has been charged with serious charges of embezzlement and corruption and misuse of funds.
The roots of the neglect and the poverty of this community of some 200,000 people did not begin today. In fact, it began decades ago with the inception of Israel onto Palestinian lands, in which the original settlers of Israel forced Germany to pay up more than $78 billion directly to Israel to be distributed instead of handing them out to the alleged victims of the Holocaust. Only a fraction of that amount was ever accounted for. Only 40% of those funds, or about $30 billion, were allocated to Holocaust survivors in Israel. Many died without ever receiving the promised allowances. Such policies by the regime are key to their current distressed circumstances. Advocates for handing out the Holocaust funds directly to recipients say that there has been major corruption in the distribution of the funds. One unofficial independent investigation into the matter found Gregory Schneider, the head of the Claims Conference, one of the regime-connected organizations that distributes the funds, report for 2014 earned $613,000 that year. Avraham Pressner, who represents the Claims Conference in Israel, receives a staggering $512,000, a salary that is almost unheard of in Israel outside of the high-tech industry. Israel's Holocaust survivors do not receive equal treatment. According to Aviv for Holocaust Survivors, a nonprofit organization, survivors who settled in Israel before 1953 receive a monthly allowance of between 500 to 25,000 euros, but those who have come after 1953, received less than 1,000 euros per year. Since its beginning, Israel is accused of using the Holocaust money from Germany to build its infrastructure, including new settlements on Palestinian lands, rather than disperse them to the intended recipients, which were the Holocaust survivors.
Since the 1950s, the West German government has been providing Israel with over $78 billion. 40% of this was meant to go to Holocaust survivors. But what happened was that Israel became the caregiver, and other various NGOs like the Claims Conference were the ones who took the money. Many of the CEOs and staff working for these NGOs earned very high salaries, and only a much far lower sums actually made it to Holocaust survivors. So now there are about 200,000 Holocaust survivors in Israel. A third of them live below the poverty line. So the money kind of got lost in the way, as it were. And these huge amounts were given to Israel, and Israel did not channel them to the right places. The The history of the Holocaust plays a very important role in the Israeli justifications for its very existence. At the same time, from the very beginning, the Israeli establishment looked down at Holocaust survivors as low beings, as people who did not fight a genocide, and therefore as people who do not deserve compassion and care. So while the Zionist movement and the Israeli propaganda worked very hard to use the Holocaust as a major building stone for the justification for the existence of the State of Israel, and while every visiting foreign dignitary has an Israeli imposed duty, almost, to visit the Israeli Holocaust Memorial, the Israeli Holocaust survivors themselves have been largely neglected and looked down upon by the Israeli regime, and they are not being properly taken care of, while money that has been meant to go to help them has been squandered to a large degree.
On social media, users had this to say. According to Dan, the Israeli regime announced a plan to assist them, but reality for many Holocaust survivors is still dismal after failures in implementation. Be Positive says, yes, land-grabbing expansionism, but using the Holocaust survivors as their reason for being, shameful. KP Caroline says, 1,000 Holocaust survivors who fled persecution in Europe die per month due to Israel's neglect today.
We decided because of the coronavirus and because of the fact that we can't bring people to this square where he was assassinated 25 years ago, we decided to spread 25,000 candles in his memory, and we invite passing by people to help us bring light to this square where he was assassinated 25 years ago.
So actually 20,000 Holocaust survivors, registered Holocaust survivors, have never received anything. And the Soviets that came to Israel, of course, and in the Soviet Union, there were no reparations paid to anybody from the war because they never received any reparations themselves. So the Soviet Jews that came in later, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, most of them have never received anything either because they came after 1952. So they don't fall under some kind of, there's a bureaucratic way that these funds are being distributed, and a lot of people are not even getting it. There's about 25% of Holocaust survivors are living in poverty, but that's not as bad in the States. It's a third of Holocaust survivors are living in poverty. Because, of course, they don't get the same funds that were going to Israel from Germany. A lot of it's just personal donations and I guess some U.S. government funds. But it's very, very complicated situation. And the corruption is fed through this complex funding, sending funds here and there and giving them out to different people. And it's very, very bizarre situation. Well, there's a great deal of hypocrisy here because originally Jabotinsky, the real Zionist mastermind from the 30s and 40s, he did not want any. When it was clear that Jews were being killed, and the expression is like lambs to slaughter, that the Zionists had no use for these Jews. They didn't want them. All they wanted were young, healthy Jews that could fight Arabs and build a new society. That was so. There was a great deal of disdain or even loathing of Holocaust survivors. So they've always had a hard time in Israel, and often Holocaust survivors would just try and hide the fact that they were living or that they'd been in concentration camps, because this was a great stain on them, that they accepted. They should have, the idea is that they should have gone down fighting. They should have been fighting the Nazis and being slaughtered. And then they would be good, clean victims.
It should be noted that some of the worst off financially are Israel's survivors of the Holocaust. After the Second World War, when Israel was incepted onto Palestinian lands, Israel allowed thousands of immigrants to register as Holocaust survivors, thus promising them compensation. The German funds were supposed to go solely to individual Holocaust survivors, but these funds have been primarily funneled through the Israeli regime. During the compensation negotiations with Germany in 1951, then Israeli Prime Minister Ben-Gurion demanded that German Chancellor Conrad give the funds directly to Tel Aviv. Since then, accountability has been limited. Funds have been diverted elsewhere. This is the main reason why today thousands of Israel's so-called Holocaust survivors remain neglected and are prone to health risks during the time of the COVID-19 pandemic. In Israel, Holocaust survivors are being left to die in poverty, all while their legacy is used as a justification for the inception of Israel onto Palestinian lands that has so badly neglected them. Here's the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. More than half of Israelis of voting age want Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to leave politics, according to a new poll published by Panels Research for the Jerusalem Post and Ma'ariv newspapers. When asked if they wanted Netanyahu to leave political life, 54% said yes, 36% said no, and 10% said they did not know. The Times of Israel. Prominent ultra-Orthodox rabbi Chaim Kanievsky has ordered Haredi boys' schools to reopen, though doing so continues to be prohibited under lockdown measures. In response, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu threatened that authorities would enforce the restrictions as much as possible. Ynet News. Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit announced he was not launching a criminal investigation into a company share deal between Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his American cousin that netted the Israeli leader an exorbitant return on investments. Mandelblit's decision caps a months-long probe into the affair, which was also linked to a separate graft case related to a possible conflict of interest involving a $2 billion purchase of German submarines. Globes. Ministry of Finance Director General Karen Turner has quit. According to Turner, the situation in the day-to-day management of the Ministry of Finance is extremely tense, with the minister tending not to follow the advice of her senior officials. The absence of a budget, and in particular, the lack of a political plan to get a budget passed, all made it difficult for her to do her work.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.